Imagine reading a breaking news alert that, a massive global military conflict is finally over.
Right.
The stock market just explodes upward, crude oil prices plummet, and I mean, the entire financial media is basically throwing a massive party.
Yeah, totally.
But deep inside a multi-billion dollar global macro fund, the smartest people in the room are quietly placing bets that the entire deal is, well, incredibly fragile.
Exactly.
Today, we are opening up an internal investment memo. It's titled U.S.-Iran Ceasefire and End of Conflict Agreement, Cross-Asset Repricing Playbook, dated June 15th, 2026. And we're going to see exactly how institutional capital moves when the world shifts on its axis.
It is just a remarkable piece of strategy to unpack, especially because it completely contradicts the public consensus right now.
Yeah, to set the stage for you, President Trump has just announced a memorandum of understanding in OU aimed at ending the U.S.-Iran war and reopening the deeply vital Strait of Hormuz.
Right, with a formal signing ceremony expected in Geneva.
Now, if you listen to casual observers, everyone is treating this as, a fully bankable peace. The war is over. This portfolio memo argues that the smart money thinks the market is getting it dead wrong.
I mean, the gap between the headline and the physical reality on the ground, that is where fortunes are made or lost.
Oh, absolutely. Now, before we jump into the mechanics of that gap, just a quick but necessary reminder. The source material today obviously touches on highly charged geopolitical events, active military conflicts, and, polarizing figures.
Yeah.
Our mission in this deep dive is strictly to analyze the financial, strategic, and market framework presented in this specific document. We aren't here to endorse any political viewpoints or take sides. We're really just looking at the math of a global shock.
Yeah.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Well, we have to start with the immediate market impulse because, the data from the moment this OU hit the news wires is just staggering.
The reaction was wild. Brent and WTI crude oil fell roughly 5%, like almost instantly.
Yeah.
You had Brent dropping down near $83 a barrel, WTI near 81, U.S. equities just ripped upward. The VIX, the market's fear gauge, dropped all the way down near 16.
It's crazy.
Airlines and cruise lines saw huge gains. And Citi even came out and cut their Brent forecasts to $70 for the fourth quarter. The market effectively threw a massive peace party.
Right. The tape immediately rewarded anything sensitive to lower fuel costs and lower inflation anxiety. But the chief investment officer who authored this memo, they view that initial reaction as a textbook head fake.
Really?
Yeah. The core thesis here is that this is a repricing event, not a peace dividend yet.
When I was reading how the market was reacting, it felt like when a massive corporate merger is announced.
Oh, yeah.
The stock price of the target company immediately jumps up near the acquisition price.
Yeah.
But the arbitragers know the antitrust regulators haven't even looked at the paperwork yet.
Exactly.
The deal could easily fall apart, but retail investors are butting in as if the ink is already dry.
That is, that's a much better way to frame it than assuming peace is just a switch you flip. I mean, investors have this terrible tendency to price ceasefires as a binary event, war or peace. Zero or one.
Right.
But this specific situation is heavily path dependent. It is a really fragile sequence of physical realities that have to happen in a very strict order for the broader economic trade to actually work.
I want to push on that because what are the actual blind spots here? I mean, yes, the market is happily buying up airline stocks, but what is it ignoring?
Just look at the actual facts on the water. A U.S. advisory explicitly states that the blockade of Iranian ports is actually still in effect pending the actual completion of the agreement.
Wow.
The blockade hasn't moved. Ship owners and insurers remain deeply cautious. Furthermore, the framework of this MOU leaves the entire nuclear program, the enriched uranium stockpiles, the broader sanctions architecture, and missile constraints entirely unresolved.
Jeez.
Not to mention, terms linked to Israel and Lebanon aren't even codified yet.
So the politicians haven't even signed the paper in Geneva yet. The physical naval blockade is still completely active. The nuclear issue is kicked down the road. But the algorithmic trading bots are acting like oil is already flowing freely through the Strait of Hormuz.
Which brings us to the most critical part of the memo, how a global macro fund strategically capitalizes on that exact mispricing.
Right.
If the piece is this shaky, where is the smart money actually moving?
What absolutely blew my mind in this memo was the cross-asset repricing map. I mean, there are clear winners, obvious losers, and some massive head-scratchers.
Yeah.
And the biggest head-scratcher for me was gold. The memo notes that after the peace announcement, gold actually rose. Wait, if global fear is dropping because we supposedly have a ceasefire, Shouldn't gold, which is the ultimate geopolitical safe haven asset, be tanking?
You'd think so.
I don't understand how a peace deal makes gold more valuable.
Well, what's fascinating here is the underlying mechanics of how these asset classes interact. It feels incredibly counterintuitive on the surface. You're right to assume the geopolitical fear of premium dropping should hurt gold, but we have to look at the chain reaction in the bond market.
Okay, walk me through the mechanism. How does oil dropping lead to gold rising?
So lower oil prices immediately ease global inflation fears. When inflation expectations drop, the market assumes the Federal Reserve won't have to keep interest rates quite as high to cool the economy down.
Right.
So the yield you can get on a U.S. Treasury bond declines.
Okay, I'm following. Lower inflation means lower yields.
Exactly. And gold is priced in U.S. dollars, but holding physical gold doesn't pay you a yield. You don't get a quarterly dividend from a gold bar.
Sure.
So when the dollar gets weaker and the yield you can get from safe government bonds drops, the opportunity cost of holding gold disappears. Gold suddenly becomes much more attractive to hold.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that lower yield and weaker dollar completely offset the reduced geopolitical demand for gold. Add in the fact that global central banks are still quietly buying it in the background, and gold's structural bid remains totally intact.
That is brilliant. It's not just a fear trade. It's a math trade based entirely on how the Federal Reserve will react to cheaper oil.
Exactly.
Speaking of oil, the memo's favorite pairing seems to be going long on airlines and cruise lines versus shorting energy beta.
Yeah.
Just to clarify for the listener, when they say shorting energy beta, they aren't just talking about betting against one specific oil company,
okay.
Right?
Not at all.
They're talking about shorting the entire energy sector's underlying market movement.
Yes. Beta refers to the broader market risk of the sector. They want to short the entire energy complex while buying airlines. It's a relative value play, but like supercharged.
Yeah.
Airlines get a massive double benefit here. First, obviously, the price of jet fuel plummets when crude oil drops. Fuel is one of their largest operating expenses. But the second, and arguably more impactful benefit, is the easing of airspace restrictions.
This is something you might not even think about unless you manage an airline's logistics. If you're flying from Europe to Asia, and the Middle East is an active war zone, you can't just fly a straight line.
No, you have to reroute flights thousands of miles out of the way. Rerouting around an entire region burns an immense amount of excess fuel, increases wear and tear on the fleet, and severely limits passenger capacity because you have to carry more fuel weight.
Wow.
So an airline isn't just saving money per gallon because oil is cheaper. They are physically burning fewer gallons, turning planes around faster, and suddenly able to sell more profitable direct routes. The margin expansion is incredibly powerful.
If you're looking at your own portfolio right now, it's tempting to see defense stocks dropping on a peace headline and think you could dump them. Peace breaks out, defense contractors lose money. But the memo specifically warns against outright shorting the defense sector.
Yeah, the author notes that the headline piece reduces geopolitical agency, which might cause a temporary dip in defense stock prices. But you have to look much deeper into how defense contracting actually works.
How so?
Well, the broader strategic rivalry between world powers and the massive global replenishment cycles remain highly supportive.
Replenishment cycles, meaning governments have to restock all the weapons and munitions they just burned through in the conflict.
What?
But how long does that actually take?
Years, often a decade. Defense contracting involves a massive lag. You have government appropriations, then the actual manufacturing, and finally revenue recognition.
It was super slow.
Very slow. The order books for these defense primes like Lockheed or Raytheon are locked in well into the 2030s. A temporary ceasefire in one specific region does absolutely nothing to cancel a five-year, multi-billion-dollar munitions contract that has already been signed.
Right.
The memo advises using defense as a relative value short, meaning you expect it to underperform airlines rather than taking on the sheer risk of betting its actual price will collapse.
So if the physical reality of shipping, defense contracts, and insurance completely contradicts the media headlines, how is this macro fund actually weaponizing that delay in their portfolio? Because knowing what to trade is only half the battle. Knowing when to execute it is where the real institutional edge lives.
They build what they call a timeline of truth. They refuse to trade the political headline. They only trade verifiable catalysts.
Interesting.
The memo breaks this down into incredibly precise horizons.
So if I'm managing billions of dollars, I can't just wait around to see if the peace holds. I need proof. Looking 1 week out from June 15th, what is the absolute first physical signal this fund is looking for?
One week out, it's about the optics and the very first physical transits. They are watching the Geneva signature process. Does the formal ceremony actually happen without a hitch?
Okay.
They are tracking satellite data for the very first actual oil tanker or liquefied natural gas transits through the strait. And crucially, they are listening to the Federal Reserve's tone to see if the central bank is actually buying into the oil disinflation story.
But the memo points to the one-month mark as the real test.
Oh, absolutely. The one-month mark is when the market will fiercely demand physical proof of normalization. Has the Strait of Hormuz actually reopened to normalized everyday commercial traffic?
Right.
Are the massive global maritime insurers like the syndicates at Lloyd's of London actually willing to write policies for these ships? And what are the specific details of the sanctions waivers?
I want to pause on the insurance aspect because that dictates everything. The politicians in Geneva don't move the oil. The actuaries in London do.
A supertanker carrying 2 million barrels of crude oil has a massive haul value, easily over $100 million. When a region is a war zone, maritime insurers attach a war risk premium to the policy.
And that's expensive.
Very. That premium isn't a flat fee. It's a percentage of the hull's value, and it's charged for a very short duration, sometimes just for a single 7-day transit. If that war risk premium stays at, say, 2%, you are paying millions of dollars extra just to sail through the strait once. That completely destroys the profit margin of the cargo. You can sign all the peace treaties you want, but if the actuaries decide the water is still too risky to insure at a normal rate, that oil is staying in the port.
And then looking 3 to 6 months out, the focus shifts to the really hard issues. Are the nuclear talks making actual progress? Has there been a sustained restart of energy output? Or is this just diplomatic drift?
Right.
This is where the chief investment officer maps out their scenario book. And this scenario book is fascinating because they assign hard probabilities to these outcomes. Let's break them down.
So the base case, which they give a 55 to 60% probability, is that the MOU holds together, but all the really difficult issues like the enriched uranium are deferred. In that muddle-through scenario, the winners are airlines and select emerging market credit. The losers are the oil risk premium and front-end inflation hedges.
Just to decode that, a front-end inflation hedge would be something like short-term treasury inflation-protected securities, right?
Yes.
Investors bought those when they were terrified. Oil would spike to $150 and cause massive short-term inflation. If we muddle through, those hedges lose value.
Exactly. Then you have the optimistic scenario, which only gets a 20 to 25% chance. This is durable flow normalization, real lasting peace. If this happens, global equities win big across the board.
But the third scenario is what caught my eye, renewed conflict. A 20% probability that the deal completely breaks down, or there's massive proxy escalation.
Yeah.
So what does this all mean? When I see a 20% chance, my first thought is that's 1 in 5. If I told you there was a 1 in 5 chance your parachute wouldn't open, you wouldn't jump out of the plane.
Definitely not.
In global finance, a 20% tail risk of total geopolitical breakdown is way too big to ignore.
It is entirely too big to ignore. In fact, the actual portfolio construction, the playbook itself, is built almost entirely around protecting against that exact 20% probability of catastrophic failure.
This brings us to the actual risk management. How does a fund protect itself when the world is celebrating? But the math says there's a 1 in 5 chance the whole region goes back to war.
They use an architectural strategy the memo calls the barbell.
Like in a gym, weight on both extreme ends, nothing in the middle.
Exactly. On the left side of the barbell, you short the most crowded conflict premia. You bet that the acute panic-driven premium in crude oil will drop. You buy the airlines. You take the obvious relief trades that everyone expects.
But on the right side of the barbell?
On the right side, you retain what they call convex protection against implementation failure. Convexity is a beautiful concept in finance. It means you pay a very small upfront cost for an incredibly asymmetric, explosive upside if things go wrong.
How are they getting that cheap protection?
Because the initial peace announcement crushed the VIX down to 16, volatility is incredibly cheap right now. The market has grown complacent, so the fund buys cheap out-of-the-money call options on crude oil and upside bets on gold and the VIX.
Oh, I see.
If the peace deal holds, your airline trades make a fortune, and your cheap options just expire worthlessly. It's a minor cost of doing business. But if the deal collapses, if that 20% scenario hits and missiles start flying again, your convex protection explodes in value. It covers all your losses on the left side of the barbell and saves the entire portfolio.
That is just brilliant risk architecture. It assumes nothing. And what I really loved about this memo was the strict discipline. I mean, they literally have a do not do list written out for their traders.
Yeah, it's very explicit.
I want to dive into these because they are so emphatic. The first one, do not run a naked short crude or short volatility book.
A naked short is one of the most dangerous positions in finance. It means you are betting the price of crude oil will go down, but you haven't purchased any underlying protection in case it rockets upward.
Right.
If a rogue drone strikes a major refinery tomorrow, the price of oil will violently gap up. A naked short position in that scenario faces literally infinite losses. You simply cannot carry that kind of unhedged risk when the underlying conflict is merely paused, not solved.
The next warning, do not buy every emerging market asset indiscriminately.
The assumption that a rising tide lifts all boats is flawed here. Just because Middle Eastern risk assets get some relief doesn't mean the fundamental structural economic problems in broader emerging markets disappear. You have to be deeply selective. Buy high-quality sovereign credit, not indiscriminate beta.
And this one is key, tying back to what we discussed about the actuaries in London. Do not assume shipping costs normalize at the exact same time as spot crude.
This is a classic timing mismatch that retail investors constantly get wrong. Spot crude oil drops immediately on a headline because it trades on a digital screen in milliseconds. But physical shipping costs are incredibly sticky.
Sticky meaning they don't go down easily, even if the underlying commodity price drops.
The physical world takes time to catch up. Bottlenecks at ports take months to clear. Those war risk insurance premiums we talked about. They normalize very, very slowly as insurers demand months of safe passage before lowering their rates. Assuming a straight, instant disinflation path for the price of global goods just because crude oil dropped 5% today is a highly dangerous assumption.
Which perfectly leads to the chief investment officer's ultimate decision rule. The golden rule for this entire event, add to peace trades only when the market gets physical proof.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the memo states it beautifully. Headlines create the first move. Cargoes, insurance, sanctions waivers, and nuclear compliance create the second. The amateur trader chases the headline. The institutional macro manager waits for the automatic identification system transponder data showing a supertanker safely clearing the strait.
It really redefines what it means to be well-informed. For you, the listener, being well-informed doesn't mean having push notifications turned on and reacting the fastest to a breaking news alert from Geneva.
No, not at all.
It means understanding the deep plumbing of the world. It means waiting for the physical mechanics, the ships, the actuaries, the central bankers, the defense contract life cycles to actually catch up to the political promises made at a podium.
It requires an immense amount of patience and rigorous discipline to sit on your hands while the broader market rallies, waiting for the physical world to validate the politicians.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Because as disciplined as this memo is, as perfectly as they map out the option spreads and the insurance premiums, there is a quiet risk mentioned deep in the scenario book that gave me pause. And it has nothing to do with finance.
You mean the proxy risk?
Yes. The memo explicitly warns its managers, do not ignore that Israel and regional proxies may not be bound by the U.S.-Iran mechanism.
It is the ultimate blind spot of bilateral agreements.
We were looking at a U.S.-Iran ceasefire, two massive state actors signing a piece of paper. But what about Hezbollah? What about Iraqi militias? What about Israel's own distinct security imperatives?
Yes.
If the massive superpowers step back and officially declare peace, does that actually end the conflict? Or does a formal U.S.-Iran withdrawal suddenly create a terrifying power vacuum in the region? A vacuum that might actually empower rogue proxies to act entirely on their own, completely untethered from the Geneva MOU, sparking a totally different kind of unpredictable shadow war.
It is the variable that no options model, no matter how sophisticated, can perfectly price. When the architects of a conflict step away, the localized forces they leave behind rarely lay down their arms quietly.
It's something to seriously mull over. A piece of paper in Geneva might calm the bond market today, but it doesn't dismantle a regional militia tomorrow. We want to thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the architecture of global macro strategy. It's a reminder that the world is far more complex than a stock ticker flashing green or red. Keep looking past the headlines, wait for the physical proof, and whatever you do, watch the shipping lanes. We'll catch you next time.